You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
An anthropological,
biological,
cross-cultural,
evolutionary,
and physiological approach to childhood from preconception to adulthood.
I'm Catherine Stewart. I live on the west coast of the South Island of New Zealand, about 43 kilometres from the nearest road end. Our nearest neighbours are maybe another 20 miles south of us as the seagull flies.
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us. So 43 kilometres, that's probably for our American listeners, that's probably what, about 25, 30 miles, I would guess?
Yes, about that. At Gorge River.
Yes, at Gorge River. So I'm looking forward to hearing a lot more about your life at Gorge River. But before we get there, can you give us a brief background of your life before you met your husband, Robert? Because you aren't originally from New Zealand, right?
I grew up in Western Australia and came here when I was 22. So I am a New Zealand citizen just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I was mainly in Perth from the time I was seven.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the University of Western Australia and did pathology and microbiology and then immunology at Royal Perth Hospital.
Wow.
So when I came to New Zealand, it was to a job at the Otago Medical School in Dunedin,
mm-hmm.
in the Autoimmunity Research Unit.
Right.
But mostly I just wanted to be in New Zealand.
Yeah. And then can you tell us how you met Robert?
There was a festival called the Towards 2000 Festival, and I went along to that with my sister-in-law's sister and also my brother. Knew each other, and
mm-hmm.
he met his future partner there and had children, and I saw Robert there, but I didn't meet him until later.
Mm-hmm.
But I did meet his next-door neighbours out on the coast. So when I visited them, I ended up bumping into him.
And then you decided to do the trek to Gorge River to see where he lived.
Yes, well, Cathy, the same person, my sister-in-law's sister, was walking in, and I was keen to do it. I'd been seeing this place on the coast had no road, and I definitely felt drawn to it in some fashion, I would have to say that. And then here she was. She was walking, so, oh, okay, can I come with you? And then next thing, Robert turned up on the doorstep and we met together.
Oh, wow. So how did you decide to stay there? I mean, you were working, you said it was Dunedin, right, working in immunology to then being in Gorge River, the most isolated place in New Zealand.
I think I had actually already left the Autoimmunity Research Unit at that point and was wanting to do something else with my life,
mm-hmm.
and was heading overseas in another month or so. So I had a couple of weeks there with Cathy and Robert walking through, and then a week at Gorge River itself. And from there I went up to Auckland to meet my sister, and we flew over to Canada and we were away for a couple of years.
Travelling around.
Yes.
And then what, you decided to come back and see Robert?
When my sister caught me up back in New Zealand, I wanted to show her that area of coast, I guess, and where I had been.
Mm.
And I suppose I had Robert in mind to some extent at that point. So we walked in to Barn Bay to where the next door neighbours were, and then fished on his boat, grey fishing that day, down to Robert's place at Gorge River, who was not home. We went in there for lunch and I left a note on the table saying, give me a call sometime, here's my phone number. I was living in Christchurch at the time, which he did several months later when he was next in town. And it just kind of happened from there. We went tramping.
Yeah.
The following year, I ended up being down there more often than not, perhaps, in and out. By the end of that year, we were doing it.
Hmm. Oh, wow. And, okay, so now your family, the Long family, you're known as the most isolated family in New Zealand. So could you describe just how remote the house is at Gorge River? Like you said, it's 43 kilometres away, but this is only by walking, right? Like there's no road or anything like that?
There's no road, but we have an airstrip. So we can fly aeroplane or a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
We've got slightly more remote lately in that a cyclone has taken quite a large bite out of our airstrip. So we've lost about half of our visitors who aren't that keen to land there anymore. It is still possible to land a plane, but you need to be pretty onto it.
Mm.
So our visitors arrived by helicopter and aeroplane, and since having our second child, we usually fly home because we always need to take home food anyway.
Hmm.
Otherwise, even to access it by boat, it's only occasional that you can get up our river. We'd have to be at low tide and on a really good day and when the river is in the right shape, the river bar.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2 days walking.
Yes, at least 2 days, because I remember reading in your book. So your book, it's called A Wife on Gorge River.
Yes.
You've talked about raising children there, and I guess when they were younger, it took a lot longer than 2 days.
Yes, although now they can do it in 1 day and race each other to keep the record down lower and lower. Yes.
Yeah.
Robert and I can still do it in two, but I've never done it in one. Robert used to.
Yeah. And it's, like I understand, it's not just a very simple, easy crossing. Like, it's very dependent on the weather and, you know, crossing rivers and things like that.
Yes, well, our main obstacle is the Cascade River. So first we have to get over that. And so if we're at home walking out, then we would be watching the weather probably for a couple of weeks ahead. That usually was Robert's job. And we would need at least 2 days after a decent rain. And if it was a big rain, it would be more than that. So you're just timing all that. When the kids were small, we would have had about 3 or 4 days even to get them to that point, not walking all day every day, but one big long one and a couple of shorter ones in that time.
Yeah. Hmm. And so you've said you got supplies flowing in after your, second child, Robin, was born. Did you ever get... Yeah, what sort of communication did you have? Did you have radios if you needed to get something urgently, or was that always something that you just waited until you were going out?
No, we never had communication at all, really. We did take home a radio when we were pregnant with Kristen, and it was more as an emergency. It wasn't until Robin was 6 months old that we decided to get a beacon, and we went out intending to get it, and then someone said, oh, I've got one you can have on the boat. We've got to change it for a new one, only it's up in Nelson. So that was the time. I've always found this harder, when you make a decision and then it gets deferred. To me, that's the worst time, when you know, you're putting yourself out there, really. So from then until Kristen went to school at 17, we just had the beacon. We couldn't radio out.
Right.
We would send letters out. And so by that time also, we were flying food in, say, once a month or so, or once every 6 weeks, whatever, and we would just give him a shopping list this time to bring next time.
Yeah.
And if we forgot something, well, we could potentially send a letter out with a tramper or somebody to him to say, please add this to the shopping list. But no, urgent. It was urgent, you just went without. Yeah.
And so you mentioned a tramper and giving letters to trampers. So I don't think we've mentioned yet that your house is located right next door to a Department of Conservation hut. So it's along a track, is that right?
Not a track, it's just a beach walk. So,
oh, okay, yeah.
They call it a route, so it's just down the beach. There is a rough track over a bluff and around a great big rock through the south where you need to get off the beach, but otherwise you're just following the beach.
Okay. And so how often would you have trampers go past, or has that varied a lot?
Well, it has certainly varied a lot. Robert tends to say 70 trampers a year. Well, it's been an awfully long time since we had 70. One year we had 12. We had 20, and 12 of those were us. That was also some time ago. Obviously, through COVID, it was been pretty quiet, but this summer, everyone suddenly got back out and got going, which has been good. We've had a few this year. So I think 40 was more like the average, and 20 be the bottom end of it.
So did you have a lot more?
Over the years, I did.
Yeah, did you have a lot more when you first moved there? Has it gotten less over the years?
Well, it has. And even for Robert to say 70, he always likes to exaggerate a little bit, make himself feel better.
Yeah.
I think 40 is a good number.
Oh, right, yeah. And what did you have in the way of, say, like fresh water to drink? Well, you had the river there, but...
We have the river, but that's tidal. So that we could always get it when we needed to, but it was an awfully long way to carry a couple of buckets of water, which I did do when we got to two children. So when I first went there, there was a water supply with a few 44-gallon drums that rust out, have holes in, so how much water you can hold gets less and less. It was fine for Robert. It was okay with two of us, but then once you start washing nappies and those bathing babies, we were already very low with first child. you think the West Coast, it rains all the time, and mostly it does, but by the time we had two children, we couldn't get through more than a week, particularly as Robert had also started to work on the back of the house, which meant that we lost half of our catchment. So with two children, I did spend quite a lot of time carrying 8 buckets of water up from the river. And then if Robert complained about the dishes not being that clean at the end of the day, I would go and get a bucket of water.
Did you have any sort of filter or anything like that?
No, it's perfectly clean. We were living in the middle of a beautiful, pristine environment.
Yes, yeah. Oh, nice.
So anyway, since then, Kristen was 1 year old when a dairy farmer and his son came from the North Island at the same time as some other hunters were in the dock hut. So they stayed with us for a few days, and it was just when it was in the middle of winter, which is often the dry spell. And they said, oh, did we need anything done? And we said, oh, it'd be nice if we could carry some water up from the river. We had already taken most of the water from the water tank next door, which we could pipe also into buckets, but not carry them so far. But there was 4 people there and then an extra 2 in our hut. So they did, but then they said, oh, you can do better than this. He said, I've got 5 dairy farms. I've got 50 kilometres of water pipe on my farm. And a couple of years later, they came down and brought us 400. He said, pace it out. So he went off for a walk in the middle of, Robert went off for a walk with Kristen, right up the top of the hill, his little tiny gumboot footprints. Came back down the hill with him on his shoulders, I think. And he said, and we needed 600 metres of pipe. So a couple of years later, he came back. He brought 400 and all the connections, everything we needed ever since, basically, except that the other 200 metres of pipe stayed in the helicopter hangar, which then burned a few weeks later before we got there, which was a bit serious. Mm. They lost their helicopter, I think.
Oh, no. Mm.
But it turned out to be a major turning point for Robert, because we were living on very little and making a point of, we don't need this, And that time Robert actually walked into the hardware shop, bought 200 metres of pipe. They delivered it to Haast for us because wherever it was, probably to Arrowtown, to the pilot, because we didn't even have a car or anything. Mm-hmm. We were hitchhiking with 2 kids at that point. And it just arrived, he said, that was easy. This is what normal people do, And it got him through that hurdle after that. If we needed something, we just went and flew and we bought it. Maybe not always.
Yeah. Makes it a lot easier. So what about for cooking? What did you have for cooking?
When I first went there in 1987, Robert had a coal range that was on its very last legs because of burning driftwood. So the hut was there. It had been left empty for 5 years before he moved into it. It was a fisherman family there before that. So the coal range, the flush toilet, the hot water system was all there and functional. He pulled the coal range out eventually, just wiggling it out piece by piece as it fell apart. But we still have the wetback and the hot water tank, which has never changed. So after that, he was using 12-gallon drums and cutting the bottom out of it so that he could get it down over the wetback. And we cooked on the hot plate on the top of that.
Mm-hmm.
Right through to 2011, we had several of those because it didn't last very long. But a friend made us a proper square box fireplace, which is 11-millimeter steel, which we put down over the same wetback, etc. And I think that will last me out, really. It's wonderful.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, great. And then what about for, the toilet and bathing? What were you just using sort of buckets? And did you have a long drop or a compost toilet or something?
No, we had the first flush toilet on the coast, which was there from the fishermen before us.
Oh, wow.
And as long as we could put water into it, the septic tank would deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, as time's gone on, we've had to clean the septic tank only once and the leach drain a couple of times. There's no shortage of water when it's raining. And the shower also, when Robert was first there, he's very tall, so to get a shower that he could actually stand under, he raised the back roof slightly and put the tank up to there. The fishermen would have just pumped it up, so we didn't use anything like that, no generators, no fuel or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd raised the roof, and the shower really, it didn't have a lot of pressure, And it, I don't know if it had got worse or whatever, but by the time Kristen was born, or say when I was there, you would have to run the hot tap low down to get it to run through, you know, to get the air out of it and so forth, to get the shower to go. And then we had this lovely bucket of nice hot water, just so that you get into the shower under a trickle. And we ended up just pouring the bucket of hot water over ourselves. It was far more practical in a much nicer shower. So for a while there, until we got the water pipe installed, which was by the time Robin was 6 months old.
Hmm.
Since then, we've had a proper shower, at least once you got the hot water back, connected back up onto the roof and so forth. We have a water tank up in a rata tree behind the house to give us the height. And we hadn't noticed, but when we first put it up, it was overflowing onto the roof. We had to raise the shepherd's crook, the pressure valve, on the roof. And then, say, 10 years later, that bit of hose fell off and there was no longer a problem. But we hadn't realised that that tree was gradually just rolling over. A rata tree is a vine that sort of grows as a spiral. And so it didn't have to fall over. It just kind of unwinds. And you see big old rata trees in the bush that they go along the ground, huge trunks going along the ground and then back up again. And
yeah. And
there was a time when suddenly it was going, not as a fall, but we could see it jiggling and see all the branches jiggling as it creaked down and down and down. And then shortly after that, we couldn't get any hot water out of the shower higher than about knee height. You need to put that on your head to wash your hair, you know.
Yeah.
That was a bit of a pain.
Oh, no.
So by this time we have, with that water pipe, we now have free-flowing water from a spring up on the hillside, nearly 600 metres away, which goes into a tank.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
And then that just overflows into a pond. We can keep things cold in the overflow and the rest just carries on down into the river. We just divert it slightly. The creek that we take it from keeps on flowing and it's all being spring-fed. We've never run out. It has got pretty low once or twice, but it's always there. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
I bless those dairy farmers every day of my life just about for having water.
Yes. Oh, fantastic. Yeah, it would have made life so much more easier and comfortable.
Well, likewise, we had hot water, you see. So long as you have water, same as a toilet. If you put it in at the top end, it comes out hot, you know. That's all you have to do. So then I was washing clothes with hot water, which made a lot of difference too.
Yeah. Oh, great. Okay, so now, let's talk about Kristen and Robin, because many of the listeners of the podcast have had home births themselves, but I'm sure many would find, you know, the isolation of Gorge River daunting in this regard. So can you tell us the solution you came to for the births of Kristen and Robin?
Well, having the first one, we were definitely a bit oblivious, and we thought, oh, well, we could do it here if we wanted to, but maybe it was just a bit silly. We chose to be a bit closer to resources. And then a friend offered us their place while they were away. There was a midwife who would come to us there. The doctors in Queenstown were not happy about it, but she did get one kind of if necessary. But if we had had to transfer to the hospital, Queenstown Hospital didn't have anything that we didn't already have on hand ourselves.
Right.
In fact, from there you would have to transfer to Invercargill.
Mm.
And I can't think of anything worse. shortly after Kristen was born, his cousin was born that was also going to be at home. They transferred to hospital. Even there, they made it somewhat of a mess of it.
Mm.
And he had cerebral palsy.
Oh.
So we were not nearly so oblivious the second time around. But we did something similar in a different house with a midwife, like a slightly closer to Invercargill. That was the only difference. It was good as gold.
So did you... the house, was it in... Yeah, you said two different houses. Were they in small towns or were they still remote but closer to towns?
One was a small farm just out of our town, so in the Waikipu Basin. The other was on a large farm but quite close to the Lumsden Hospital, Lumsden Maternity Hospital at the time.
Ah, okay, yeah. And how did you go in terms of like the time frame, just working out... Did you walk out or did you helicopter out I'm just trying to picture this when you're heavily pregnant.
Exactly, yes. At 7 months with the first one, we walked down to our neighbour about 25 miles south and went fishing for 2 months, cray fishing. And from there, we had intended to fly out. So there was the day, about 2 weeks early. So So there was the day when there were planes on the beach. It was whitebait season. But a prey fisherman had said, I'll take you out tomorrow. I'm coming back, and I'll pick you up and take you down to Milford Sound. So, and we were we didn't have money to spend, really, so it was, you know, that was a free option, so we took it. Except that he forgot. By which time the aeroplanes were gone, and the next day was not so good with it. So the next day I had to get onto the little tiny crayfishing boat, the double hull sort of catamaran thing, outboard motors, and fished around to Martin's Bay, and from there we caught the last plane out just up into the Hollyford Valley. Murray Gunn picked us up there. He got a bus out to Tiarnow and bussed around to Queenstown. The second time we just flew out, like, I don't want to do this. We're just going to fly out. And we had the baby, we had the child as well at that point.
Yeah. And then what about coming back home with a newborn? Did you walk in or, fly in?
I had insisted. We had a deal with the first one that I was not walking home. This was something that was worth spending money on. Robert had spent much of the time of our pregnancy getting the airstrip up to a much better condition. Prior to that, we were pretty much down to aeroplanes not landing. They could, he would keep the flexes down, cut them down, but they would be under your wings.
Right.
So we figured that we would be using it, but we still didn't have the money to spend on it. So between Kristen, he was 3 years old by the time Robin was born, in that 3 years, we paid for that one flight. In fact, we ended up bartering for a painting. And otherwise, we only flew when somebody else, so for example, my mum or Robert's mum, were coming to visit, and they would pay for the flight. And also after our wedding, I think, a wedding present was to fly us home that time too, with Robert's parents for the honeymoon. I think Kristen was a year old. But once we had the second child, it was just, everything was more difficult because we could only go. When you had one child in a backpack, you can still get there, and, you know, if things are starting to change, if it's raining or whatever, and you know where you're going, you can get there. Once you've got a three-year-old walking, you just don't have that leeway.
No.
Plus a baby, etc. So that's when things changed. We could go out more. We could go out carefully. We usually couldn't get back well anyway. They were either sick or we always needed to bring food home. So at that point, after she was born, after she was 6 months old, in fact, from then we had always flown back home.
And so, so after they were born, how long did you wait before returning home?
I was probably ready to go by 2 to 3 weeks, but each time we ended up doing it at 4 weeks because the weather went bad or the aeroplane went away or whatever happened, So 4 weeks. And it was so nice to get home by that time because you're in your own place, you've got your own setup, you know. It actually got quite stressful being out by then.
Yeah, true. And especially with Kristen, because you'd been out fishing for a couple of months before, so you hadn't been home for quite a while.
Yes, although it didn't really matter. We used to move around a lot then. It was particularly after Robin was born that we realised that it just wasn't practical. That's when we went down to just twice a year. We just stayed home.
Right. And, okay, so, I'm most curious about, raising children at Gorge River, and you really do go into depth about this in your book, A Wife on Gorge River. I'm sure some of the most prevalent questions that the listeners have are how you dealt with things like sickness and injuries without having an emergency room close by to rush to if necessary.
Right, well, even to at the point when my son left home to school, I explained it to him that we just lived on faith, like we just don't do that. And you keep your brain in place, but it's more than just your brain. It's, the universe looks after you so long as you make that effort. And I told it to him then, like, theoretically I could still do this to you when you're away, but hey, it's actually up to you to do it to yourself as well. And now they come back to me and, I've just fallen over on the beach yet again and whacked my knee and I can't walk for a week. And my son says, just don't. Basically, the belief system, just don't. And I say, well, I didn't all the way until I did. But it's definitely a state of mind that keeps you that way.
Yeah.
So no, we didn't have anything serious at all.
Good, yeah.
And the things that we did have, we dealt with as we needed to.
Yeah. And you've mentioned in your book that sickness wasn't really an issue unless you actually came out into the rest of the world.
Yes, and people are saying that right now about COVID. Without having all the tourists coming at the moment, we're missing out on all the bugs that they would have brought us.
Mm.
Some people think our immune systems are going down, just losing. I'd say, yeah, great, bring in the tourists. We need some more nasty bugs, you know. But to some extent, it's like that. But I personally think the worst thing was that we walked them out. So they arrived exhausted, or at least not well, you know, not full. At home, they were just perfectly fine.
Yeah.
But then then they had to start coping with electric lights and people everywhere. And Kristen particularly was really quiet, the less robust one. Robin was more robust. He would be coping, and then if something just kind of flicked him or something was just a bit hard or whatever, he could get sick even without catching the local bugs.
Mm.
And it took me a long time to figure out what was going on for him there. And for himself to figure it out too, and just choose not to do it anymore.
Right.
As teenagers, they both did something.
Hmm. And yeah, you're talking about how at the end of the walk out to the road they would be exhausted. How did you manage those walks out with the children? Did you go slowly with Kristen walking while you carried Robin as a baby? And then, yeah, how long did it take? And yeah, I'm very curious about the whole logistics.
So, yeah, Robin was 6 months old when we did the first trip out, and that trip, you would have to hold Kristen's hand. He'd been walking before that, admittedly. He walked a third of the way out when I was just pregnant. So maybe that trip. You're holding his hand, but he's too busy looking at the birds and the sky and everything else, the sea. And, you'd be the one putting his foot in the right rock kind of thing. By the second, and that was the only trip I have had where I was standing around able to look at the scenery. The rest of the time, Robert was so fast that, you know, I was just head down trying to keep up. By the next trip out with Kristen, he was as fast as I was. It was literally the only one that happened. So again, with Robin, same thing. The first trip at just, say, 3.5 was like that, and then after that they were off.
Yeah.
I was a slow one again.
Oh, no. Yeah. So was it at 3.5 that they were actually able to do that whole distance on their own?
Yep.
Wow, that's impressive.
I think most children are. Again, that's in the head. And they just...
Yes.
They never questioned that they were going to.
Yeah. It's the method of transport. That's just what everybody else is doing. So that's what they'll do.
Yes. There's a lot to do with temperament. People can have kids who just won't. I've got a great nephew at the moment who just won't.
And what about life at home? What sort of play kept them amused? Like, you know, homemade toys or imaginative play, etc. What were their interests?
I think, we thought perhaps that play really is about learning to be an adult. So they're learning from you all the time. So even Christian was 1 year old, and we had a whale vertebra that he could sit on, like a little stool with his feet down the hole where the spinal cord goes. And he would be filing on it, just like Robert did. Robert used to do all his carving at that point by hand. Then as Robert got a little bit of machinery, he had a treadle wheel for a while. Perhaps that was after Robin was born. And Kristen, otherwise he would work greenstone on sandstone just by hand. And so Kristen used to do all that as well. So he'd just be standing up. So a lot of your learning is just what you're doing each day, working in the garden, whatever. They did whatever we did. And then play, so in the larger world, Kristen was never interested in playing with cars. He got this huge box of cars and they just sort of sat in the corner, really. But he played with helicopters and aeroplanes because that's what we were seeing around us, boats.
Yeah.
There's a lovely picture when Robin was a tiny baby lying in her pram, Kristen sitting in the top bed part of a pram, which she slept in. And Kristen sitting in that as well, rowing the boat with a baby in it, because that's what we did, you know, we rowed boats.
Yeah.
And then a really funny time, somebody came with an outboard motor and a little blow-up dinghy, and they took it out to sea and went out to the island and went fishing. And after that, Kristen came up with a retractable tape measure, so he could pull the ripcord, you know, pull the start cord on the outboard motor.
That's so creative.
So it's so much fun watching them do that completely of their own accord, you know, when it comes out of them.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about, because you're right next to the river, and I'm thinking of things like, you know, heavy rain and flooding and the ocean a short walk away and, like, the mountains with landslips. Were you ever extra, did you have to be extra cautious about them playing outside in their safety, or were they quite careful and cautious?
Yes, that's a really good question. I believe that Kristen learnt it on our back. So the river was the main thing. Learnt it on our back in that first year before we could walk. I have known other children of white baiters, for example, who are not there all year, come to the white bait season, and they literally walk straight off the end of the stand. You just fish them out. But her first boy did that. Her second boy, she had to tie him up. It was so funny. Because if she looked away, he would just go straight into the river. There was just no stopping him. And Kristen is definitely very cautious. I don't know whether, I think it would be of his temperament anyway, but he certainly learnt that from us to the point where he was the boring one. You know, the cousins would just ruck him up because he was the youngest as well. And he'd say, put me ashore, you know, because they were rocking the dinghy or so on. And then as he's grown up, he's still very good at, he does risky things now, he climbs mountains and kayaks and so forth, but I think he's very good at calculating that risk.
Yes, yeah. And what about Robin?
I guess really the second one just follows along, so she was fine. So yeah, they didn't swim in the river by themselves until they were in their teenage probably.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So we just had one incident. So there was the river, and then B, there was the bush. And there was one incident where Kristen was following me to do the washing, but he'd gone one way by mistake and gone down to the river. Mm-hmm. When he got there and I was not there and he kind of didn't know what to do, well, he didn't just walk straight to the river. He sat up on a log, the log where Robert scaled fish every day with Kristen. He'd go down with him and waited to see what happened next, really. And so here I am.
Yeah.
Where's Kristen? Robert doesn't know. Looked at the riverbed first, but I was really more worried about the bush. You only had to take 10 steps to the bush.
Yeah.
And didn't know what to do at that point. I think we did a bit of calling or something. I can't actually remember now. And so it was probably another 5 minutes before I went back down to the river, and there he was, just sitting on the log, 20 metres away from any water, any danger, just wondering. He didn't know what to do, so just like a duckling, really. Sit down and wait for your mum to come.
Oh, fantastic, yeah. And was sibling rivalry an issue, or did they mostly just get along reasonably well?
Oh, no, they're the classic kids who just fought all the time, but have a really good relationship when they stop, and particularly as adults, I think. But it was quite a useful thing when it came to homeschooling. They were 3 years apart, so it was a decent gap in terms of schooling. But Kristen, yeah. I always, you know, I tried to make schooling interesting and so forth, but his temperament was just to basically argue with everything. It didn't matter what I did in the end, so he didn't want to do it. So Robin, the second one comes along, and they just follow along, and that's easy. But we were actually able to use her as a prod for him. So, come on, Robin can do this. You know, probably wasn't fair. I don't know if it would be PC to do that these days, but come on, she can do this. Smart up. I mean, otherwise, sibling rivalry, well, she was always a lot smaller. So it's funny in his book where he sort of says, you know, he would say he would be the director of any games, and he says, but that's the privilege of being an older brother, you know.
True, yeah.
But yeah, there'd be a lot of scrapping going on, and they'd drive me nuts, kind of. I'd have to be taking her side all the time because she was a little one.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering how you coped without having, I mean, you had Robert, but you didn't really have much of a village in terms of support. It was just you always there to look after them. How did you find that?
Yes, nor could I just call somebody on the phone.
Mm.
That was probably the tough part, yes. So at that stage, communication was only by writing letters, yes. Probably more after Robin was born, I did get into the habit of making a phone call to my sister and my mum when I was out. But that would be on other people's phones. It was quite difficult. My sister was in America at the time. But I could make a call and have them ring me back, for example. But even that, when you're staying in someone's house or you're there for the evening, you can't just say, oh, excuse me, can I just go and use the phone? You know, you're supposed to be there talking to them.
Yeah.
So that was always tough. My sister had a child 9 months ahead of Kristen and another one ahead of Robin. So over the long term, she was the one who really helped in, you know, disciplinary problems and things that I was really having trouble with or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a long process.
What about their education, can you tell us, because you mentioned homeschooling, can you tell us how that worked?
We first heard about homeschooling from our first midwife. So before that, the neighbours on either side had been on correspondence school.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And both of those, there's a different time to that. They get sick of it, you know. So that by the time Kristen was thoroughly sick of homeschooling, and we should have stopped, say, at intermediate, he went on to correspondence for high school, and then the following year, Robin went at intermediate. And I knew, actually, 2 years earlier that I really thought Kristen needed something else. But it meant that we still had correspondence to go to, because after that, boarding school, which was not really much of an option. And that meant that he had things coming in from outside. You know, he needed more from his village, basically, or whatever. And he wasn't arguing with me. But, you know, I wasn't the one telling him he had to do this, which was boring. So it's not my problem, you know. You tell your teacher it was boring. But he never did, of course. He had quite a different attitude because he was enjoying it so much. Whereas homeschooling itself, I think, is just a pretty natural thing in that in an environment where you don't have a lot of things from outside. We tried to start just as an extension of what you were doing. So when we applied to the Ministry of Education for an exemption from being enrolled in a school, mm-hmm. and we had to present our curriculum and so forth, well, we included things like, we included a subject called life skills, which therefore covered fishing and gardening and all those sort of things.
Oh, yeah.
So they counted as schoolwork, basically, yeah.
Yeah, cool. And then they went to, what was that, Mount Aspiring College? Is that boarding school for their final year of high school?
It was the final year. There is a hostel there for 30 kids a year, and they have an outdoors pursuits program, which was right up their alley. Mm-hmm. But Kristen was too late to apply for that. So he actually flattered with a friend who was, a friend of his, but she was my age. She wasn't even there all the time. But he was 17, 18 by the end of the year, and as far as I was concerned, I trusted him. He was ready to go. He was ready to look after himself.
Yeah.
Robin applied sooner and got into the hostel, which I preferred, knowing that she was there. Kristen spent most of his time hanging out with the hostel anyway. But at Mount Aspiring College, where you've got 30 people at least coming in every year, new students, makes it that much easier than trying to go to a boarding school in Dunedin where everyone's been there for 5 years already. That worked really well.
True, yeah. And did they come back to visit you during that final year at all?
Yes.
Or was this like a sudden difference for the whole family dynamics?
Well, firstly, that's when we got the internet. And we spoke to Kristen every couple of days. Because he needed it. And actually, we really needed it. It was really awful at home with him gone and really hard on Robin for a further 3 years. And such a big change for all of us. But he was fine. He was having a great time, and that really helped. You know, we were still part of his life. He could still ask for advice when he was, this was in the year of some nasty flu. He could ask us, at what point do I go to the doctor, that kind of thing. So, yes, the first and the third terms, he came home with a supply drop for us. So he was there for a couple of hours and then went back out again. He came home for the three holidays, 3 times 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. One of those, we were out for 2 weeks with him before the holidays, and then he came home with us.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, we saw him twice a term, basically.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then was it about the same sort of thing with Robin?
Yes, basically. It would have been exactly the same numbers, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And now, yeah, reading your book, this is kind of like change of subject, but you wrote about a famine, the 1999 famine, which sounded like a serious challenge for the whole family. Can you tell us a bit about this?
The problem was that our pilot, who we relied on by that time, had driven, taxied his plane into a bit of a hole and twisted his undercarriage, and it just took so long to get fixed. So we had asked him, and we had no message, no ability to receive a message from him. So we had asked him to come by the end of April with the next load, and the end of April came and went, and there's no sign. And also by this time, May gets really quiet. We have a lot of people come there, helicopter in through April for the deer hunting season, the raw, and then that was all over. So May is really quiet, and you know, weeks were going by, and then an aeroplane did go by, which turned out we didn't know at that point, but it was his father-in-law who came in and dropped the food that we had left in the hangar, I guess, and probably a load of groceries as well, and then he told us what had happened. So that was early in May. We came out, say, in July, and spoke to him on the phone then, and he said 3 more weeks, something like that. And we flew back by helicopter that time with the local company, and we took as much food as we could, which was not a lot with 4 people in a helicopter. You didn't want to be overloading him.
Mm.
They would have been doing a cheap trip for us as well. But then he didn't come. So after the plane finally got fixed, then it took several more weeks to get it painted, and time sort of went by. And so in that April trip, we got 25 kilos of milk powder, and that lasted us right through. We also had bags of wheat I used to grind to make flour. So we were long since out of flour and then wheat. We had no oil. And we got down, for the last month or so, the kids were eating rice and sugar and milk and sultanas several times a day. And Robert was spending all his time fishing and getting seafood. There's also winter, so it was quite hard to fish.
Mm.
But, you know, when you've got fish but no cooking oil or no flour or anything to go with it, it gets a bit boring.
Yeah.
But that was okay. We were actually having quite a good time. It was fun.
Yeah.
And then he came at the beginning of September, and he took us down to Big Bay for a week or two, where we went white baiting, which we often did at that time of year. And down there, you know, you get fed venison stew and all sorts of things. So we had a good old feed up. And then came home, and we said, now we're going to need you in, I think, 3 weeks, because the food that we did have wasn't going to last long. Everything else was gone. We also had split peas. That was the only other thing. So literally we had milk powder, split peas, and we probably still had a bit of rice then. But as that 3 weeks turned into another 5 weeks, because somebody else had told him that we were coming out soon and he didn't come. And the fifth week of that, so I was grinding the wheat. We had 15 kilos of wheat. I would put it up by the stove for a few days or up to a week to dry before I ground it. And I went to get some more wheat to put up there and realised that that was it. That was the last of the wheat. We had been through 15 kilos of wheat in about 4 weeks or something because there was nothing else.
Oh, no.
And, you know, that would have lasted 6 months usually.
Yeah.
And there was an aeroplane there at the time. So that week we had 4 people drop in, and 4 planes drop in. Each of them brought us bread, and one of them also brought us some butter and some cheese. And we were catching a little bit, a quarter of a cup of white bait each day. We must have had some eggs at the beginning of that time. And so in that week, we were living on white bait and bread, basically. And then the last pilot, we asked him to make a phone call and see what was going on. And so the pilot got the phone call and then went away mustering for another week, I guess it was.
Mm.
And then finally came. So we didn't know what was going on. I did a walk up to Barn Bay. We were coming out, but the two kids by that time, we couldn't carry enough food to get all the way out. So one of us used to take a bit of food up to Barn Bay in case, and sometimes we got stuck there for a few days waiting for weather as well. So I literally took the last little bit of millet and the last little bit of rice up to Barn Bay to make porridge and a couple of other things, I forget. And when I came back, he had been. We had bacon and eggs and fish and chips for tea that night.
Oh, wow.
It was party time, yeah. When we actually did the walk out then, because I'd only taken so little, we'd run out of time to do the full load. Robert actually was ferrying food ahead, coming back for a second load on that walk, the 6 or 8 hour day walk.
Because in your book you said how after you finally got all that food, I can't remember your exact words, but you guys didn't feel...
Robert said, Robert said, actually, I felt better before you. Not necessarily stomach-wise, although I think he was referring to that, but particularly, he just really enjoyed that feeling of the clarity and the focus on the next meal, the providing for your family.
Oh, right, yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
But hey, I also said in the book, you know, it's only 2 days walk to the shop.
True, like, yes.
You know, here we were doing it, but hey, this is not. We ate, for example, we ate all our potatoes. It was Christmas time when I was asking for potatoes and the pilot said, well, haven't you got any of your own? And I said, well, we ate them. But, you know, in Ireland, you would never eat your seed potatoes.
True, yes. How old were the kids at the time?
They were about 5 and 8, so it was fun.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Now, you had a chapter in your book about your pets or your animals. Can you give us a brief rundown on them?
Well, the main one is our chook. So So Chucky
yeah.
came home with us just as a fluffball. She was hatched in May, so she wasn't going to survive. And this is at the same place where Kristen was born. So, you know, we had a lot of, they're almost like auntie and uncle to the children. So because we didn't have any neighbours, we couldn't leave her there and ask them to feed her. So she had to come with us wherever we went. So she rode, we had a system that gradually, she rode in the top pocket of Kristen's pack. And then later, when I went to buy Robin a pack for her 13th birthday, we had to look at every pack in Queenstown looking for a pack with a chalk pocket. It was hilarious. Chucky used to go in the car with us and in the aeroplane and so forth. The only time we left her was if we went to Australia, for example, for a month or two, and she'd have to, and then we took her back to the chalk farm. She stayed there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But you guys were never able to have any sort of other pets. I guess, yeah, logistically, when you're going out for quite a while at a time, it wasn't very feasible.
When Robert first went there was a cat that had been left behind by the fisherman's family.
Oh.
But it had looked after itself for 5 years, eating rabbits and so forth.
Oh, wow.
It was still there for perhaps his first year or so before she died. After that, the rabbits became a problem.
Mm.
But also the birds came closer. I think the birds at the time had sort of learned to, you know, they were more wary, definitely. No doubt she got a few of them.
Yeah.
So a cat was not really the sort of pet that you'd want there. There are no cats, no wild cats down there. And then a dog, it would have been more fun, and it could have walked out with us, but we were still hitchhiking at that point. We were already hitchhiking with two babies, you know, to have a dog as well, which is not really worked well. And
true.
And we couldn't have fed a dog.
No, yeah.
Because we were just feeding ourselves.
Mm, yeah. Now, Kristen and Robin's kind of personal interest as they grew. In your book, it seemed like Kristen was often out, you know, and I'm thinking in late childhood, teenage years, seemed he was often out trapping possums, and Robin was quite into creative sort of projects. So are there other memories that stand out in these sort of years as to what occupied them?
Yeah, well, possums only showed up when Kristen was about 12. We didn't have any when I was first there.
Oh, wow.
It's a rare thing in the country now. Even when Robert first came in 1980, there was no possums at Big Bay.
Wow.
They had been introduced into the Holyford Valley way back, over 100 years ago.
Mm.
But I guess their numbers just hadn't grown up enough for them to be pushing. Now they've pushed to Big Bay, they've pushed on up to our place, and it's a major job. The last few years, there's a Martins Bay Trust and now also a Big Bay Trust starting to get started, and there's been a bit of 1080 going on, docs helping them on the side of their trust. And so the possums that were being pushed up towards us are now A, not being pushed so hard, and B, potentially turning back around and going back to the vacuum and hopefully being cleaned up again. So our possum numbers have gone down a third in the last maybe 3 or 4 years or something. Which is really nice because Robert's getting old for trapping possums. Kristen's thoroughly over catching possums several years ago. I still sew skins. That's sort of my home business because Robert's still catching them, but both of us will be delighted when you don't need to. We were both vegetarian when we went there up to the time when Kristen was born. Kristen was conceived. And I got hungry. So, you know, there's nothing nice about trapping possums, but we're watching the trees die. No, I feel pretty strongly about what we're doing for the sake of the forest.
Yeah.
It's not nice watching that happen.
Wait, is that what, from them eating the berries, or what is it that they're doing to damage the trees?
Yeah, a possum in Australia, it browses the trees, and the trees change, so the leaves... I think it's to do with tannins and things. The leaves become bitter. The possum or the koala moves on to the next tree because they don't want to eat it anymore. So they only ever have a small amount of each tree. That's why a koala particularly needs such a large territory because they have to be able to move. The same in Africa. If a giraffe chews on an acacia tree, not only does that tree change, but it has pheromones that blow downwind, and the trees downwind of it will change in response. A giraffe tends to work its way upwind. In New Zealand, a rata tree is very closely related to a gum tree, eucalyptus. They're both myrtles. And the possums just love them, but the tree hasn't evolved with browsers. So it doesn't respond. So the possum will sit there and eat all the leaves. All the fresh, young leaves are the best. Until the tree just exhausts itself.
Mm.
And we're watching the line of grey skeletons coming around the hill towards us. We can see them now for 3 years.
Oh, no. Mm. Yeah. Just simply from possums. Wow. Now, so despite living so isolated from reading your book and from, you know, talking back and forth with you just to arrange this time to chat, it seems like you get out into town a lot and you get a lot of visitors, and it seems like you made a lot of trips to Australia over the years. So while isolated, it doesn't seem, to me at least, that Kristen and Robin were lacking socially at all. Would you agree there?
Absolutely, yes. And so when they were little, and we have other friends who have lived in an isolated place in the Ulster Sounds who had the same story, he said, it was his quote and I really loved it, he said, when they were little, people said that you were depriving them. And now that they're grown up, people say, how come they turned out so well? And that's exactly the case for our children. So,
yes.
Back then, we were coming out twice a year, but it would be a good old trip when we did. So at the very least, we came up to Haast. They would go to the local school for a week or so, week or two, a couple of times a year. A lot of their social life was writing letters, which was their schoolwork, to a family of really close friends who came in 3 or 4 times over the years, and cousins. So they were a sort of a main, as far as village went, we just did it. Well, that's one side of the village was just to do it by post, and the other side of the village was our neighbours, even if they are 20 miles away. It's still a village. You see them less often, but they're filling the same role in a way. You can't have a cup of coffee, you know, complain about whatever, but you still do twice a year or something.
Mm.
So, yes, when they were little, that was something that I worried about. The cousins in Australia, on Robert's side, we would go there for 4 to 6 weeks or so at a time over the summer holidays or something, and their cousins over there went to flash schools and had everything and T-shirts with fancy names on them and so forth. And I was aware of my kids feeling like they were missing out. Well, it just didn't happen. Like, maybe the first trip he was too small, but by the second trip even, he would be looking at them and thinking, I'm not missing anything here. And that made my life easy.
Mm. Nice, yeah. That's so good.
Yeah.
How old are Kristen and Robin now?
30 and 27.
And can you tell us what life looks like for the four of you now that they're adults?
Kristen was in Norway, in Arctic Norway, when COVID struck and Norway shut down. He had about up to 300 tourists a day coming out to do dog sledding, and 300 dogs also. So when he flew out, that was March. Previous November, he flew out from our place, and in his conversation to the pilot, he was saying, oh, I've never had anything to do with animals apart from killing them, you know, possums and so forth, deer. And he was off to play with dogs. So, say, after we spoke to him at Christmas, which was within a month of him getting there, and he was saying, I'm absolutely covered in dog hair, dog food, dog vomit. So there's dogs everywhere. There's dogs under the table and in everybody's beds. But his flat, which was his bedroom, another bedroom, and then the bathroom's 100 metres away outside of the dining room. He said, our flat is the only dog-free zone. within a month, he said, oh, no, we've got dogs in our beds too. And he just came to love dogs.
Yeah.
It was really nice for him. And he said, there's people here who know every dog by name and temperament and who they can run with and what point in the team they need to be. And he was just learning 30 dogs and working with them. Well, then through COVID, he ended up staying through that summer and the following winter. That was with no tourists, but the following winter he did a lot of training of the puppies who were coming up and the racing dogs. His boss was one of the most respected racers in Norway, and there was a 1,000-kilometre race coming up in March, although unfortunately got cancelled for COVID, but they were training for that. And by the end of that, he was that person. He knew all the dogs, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow.
And he had also been training dogs on his own, running them 60 up to 120 kilometres in a day, mainly with a four-wheeler behind because there wasn't always enough snow that year. and, you know, they'd wrap the four-wheeler around the tree or whatever. And if you've got 20 dogs pulling a four-wheeler, you can't hold them. The only thing he could do was to tie it off to a tree. And dealing with the problems out in the snow on his own, 20 dogs pulling, taking off in all directions. And that, you know, was just an amazing experience for him.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So Kristen has done a lot of travelling. I think I saw over 50 countries.
Yes, I can't remember the number. Yep. He's been to Antarctica and a few things. So, in fact, while he was, it was during that first lockdown, he was in Norway, and there's a show on the radio here on Sunday mornings called Calling Home. So while we were also locked down by that time, and they called him in Norway, and they said, "Oh, you're just about the furthest away from here that you as you could possibly be." And a lot of the other people who were came on the radio once a week or so with, you know, "I'm in Peru and I can't get home," sort of thing. And he said, "I'm in Norway and I'm having a great time." And through that, the following week, he received two offers to write a book. So he ended up having to choose between them.
Wow.
And he had a year to do it. So when he did injure himself and wasn't able to work, that was one thing he could sit down and write. And then when he finally had to leave Norway, he'd been through 3 times 6 months. Of work visa, and he had to go. So he got into MIQ here just when the Australian bubble opened up, so there was space. Otherwise, there was nowhere. You know, he couldn't get in. So he didn't know what he was going to do at that point. He had a work permit for Sweden. Would have been happy to go onto there, but there was no guarantee that they would let him through the border on the day. So you really, literally, have to leave one place and there's nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
So he came home and let. He got through the MIQ 2 weeks easily by writing his book. And then he came home to us, which was really lovely, and was there for about 6 weeks and got it mainly written and submitted in that time. In the next few months, nice. You know, going to and fro and so forth. So his book is due out in about a month, in April of this year.
And what did you say it's called?
It's called A Boy from Gorge River, which was sort of inevitable.
Nice. That's great. Oh, I'm looking forward to reading it. So because your book is A Wife on Gorge River, and Robert's book, which was the first that you've written. What was his one called?
A Life on Gorge River.
So that's penguin, a running theme.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's right. So Random House came up with their title, A Life on Gorge River. So I thought, well, I guess that makes me A Wife on Gorge River, which I didn't particularly want to write it. But it was so successful that you sort of had to do it. So that was really logical. And then we weren't quite sure how he would put his, but they came up with that as well. And now poor old Robin, who has always said, so long as he doesn't write one, I won't have to. We wait to see.
Oh, dear. And now, so tell us what Robin's up to. I understand she's doing some conservation work.
Yes. After school, she had a couple of summers on Kapiti Island with the Māori family there and as a guide, a Kiwi guide. People come out to there, stay overnight, just a few people, permits and everything, and she would take them out to see a Kiwi. So even before that, she's the bird person in the family, and I am, to a large extent, sort of with her. There was 100 people applied for that job, and she asked them later, how come you chose me? And they said, oh, well, everybody else said, I like birds, but you said, I've done this, and I've done this, and I've done this. We had been out together with doc people to rescue kiwi eggs that would then be incubated and raised and put back into the sanctuary when they were big enough to deal with the stoat, Operation Nest Egg, that was called. We'd also been to Kapiti Island and fed out to kakapo at the end of a breeding season when the chicks were just leaving the nest, so things like that. And so she did that for a couple of summers. She worked on a ski field, and then she got a job. It's with DOC, but it's sort of, they're not there much. They're out. She spent 6 summers, I think, out in the all sorts of places. There's a grid system throughout the South Island of New Zealand, docked land. Every 8 kilometres on a grid, there's a 20-metre square plot. So she started out surveying the number of possums and deer and other mammals, goats, so forth. Within 3 weeks, she showed that she was good enough to be the bird listener. So she would do the 5-minute bird counts at various times while the other people did the vegetation on the plot, and then later, when she got bored, because there's not that many birds in New Zealand, she knew everything after a year, so she got into the botany of it as well. She thought the botany would keep her going for a long time, but actually even with that, she knew almost all of it sort of within a couple of years and was ready to move on. So then with COVID, she was ready to go over to Canada to work for a year or so, and she wanted to spend a bit of time living in a city as well. But that came to a halt. So she thought, well, it was actually high time she got herself to university, which she'd never had time for before. She didn't want to sit there for 3 years being told what to do, how to do what she'd been doing all her life, you know. But she, on the basis of her work for 6 or 7 years, she got straight into a postgrad diploma.
Oh, wow.
So she came out of that last year with a first class honours.
Oh, good on her.
That was in Dunedin. And this year she's at Lincoln doing a master's on alpine jumping spiders.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
A little known cryptic species, yeah. So her passion really is things that are obscure and people don't know about. She says, if you don't know about it, you can't care about it.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that's nice.
Robin is also, has been for some years now, a trustee on the Penguin West Coast Penguin Trust. We have Tawaki, the Fiordland penguin, in our backyard, basically. When she started, so when she was about 17, we heard that the West Coast Penguin Trust was putting out cameras on nests at Jackson Bay and also another outfit at Milford Sound. And this really was her master's project that she'd been working on, potentially. I mean, she's only 17, but it was her potential project. She said, is there anything that we can do here that you could be comparing with your results there? And they said, yeah. So next thing we had 10 nest cameras as well. And for 3 years, she was putting them out during the breeding season. And when she took off to go to work, I would take over. So I'm also a penguin ranger now with the trust. She's a trustee. Mm-hmm. She's actually the chairman at the moment. And she has been doing a lot of surveying of where they are, because they are the forest penguin, little known. There's been very little done on them up to that point. There was a survey done on them about maybe 25 years ago now, which found around the whole of Fiordland and I think about the west coast, which showed that there was 2,500 breeding pairs of them. Well, she took off with a backpack and surveyed north of our place from Cascade Point down to Martin's Bay and found 1,000 pairs, 1,000 nests, just in that small area. There was still the whole of Fiordland and also the Stewart Island that she hadn't even started on yet.
Right.
So 11 or 12 years later, 10 years later, she put up a nice map of with red lines of where she had done it, and it's still very, very little. And they have, purely, really, on the basis of her counts, they are now saying there's probably 12,000 pairs.
Oh, wow.
So she put up the population by a third just in 50 miles, 50 kilometres.
Yeah.
And it's really just because if you're looking. They're not standing out on the beach like they do in the Auckland Islands.
Yeah.
It's a matter of how hard you look. And even as she subsequently looked again, you know, she'll find a few more each time. But it does not say they're doing well by any means, but they're okay, you know, it could be a lot worse.
Yes. Yeah. So did she just kind of go out of curiosity to kind of, oh, I'm going to go find out what it really is like?
Well, no, she'd already been watching them for 11 years near our place.
Yeah.
So they're nesting just sort of, they start, you know, half a kilometre away or so. She used to get up there and check them out during the breeding season, keep an eye on them. So she already had records from when she was about, I did say 11 years, so from when she was about 11 she started that.
Huh, wow. Good on her.
Yeah. And there's 400 pairs in the first 3 kilometres from our house.
Oh, wow.
So, they were just in the backyard. The New Zealand Geographic has said that she's probably the world's leading expert on finding this particular penguin in the bush, which is only because of the lack of competition and just how hard you look. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's great. Very cool. Now, can you tell us what you and Robert are doing now? Because I'm imagining for most of the time it's just the two of you at Cord River now?
Yes. So Robert just carries on doing what he's always done, which is painting landscapes, oil and canvas, and greenstone carving, and he's always got more orders ahead of him than he can shake a stick at, really. He just does what he can and gradually moves through it. He's 66 now. He would like to slow down a bit, possibly has slowed down slightly, but has more to do with who's demanding what and by when.
Yeah.
And he spends perhaps slightly less than a third of his time doing possums now. So, you know, the prospect of them actually diminishing in the future is great.
Yes, yeah.
I then buy the skins off him so that he's got paid for his work, and I send them out to be tanned, and they come back not smelly and all nice and ready to go. And I turn them into bedspreads and cushions and scarves and so forth and sell them on Trade Me or by word of mouth.
Nice, yeah. Yeah, I saw those on your website and they look so cosy.
Yes, it's lovely stuff. I mean, fur is a wonderfully luxurious thing. That's why we did that. That's why we bought them and possums here in the first place.
Yeah.
Kristen also makes and sells fur hats, which he's worn in Antarctica to minus 43 degrees without being cold. He sells them as Arctic expedition hats on his website.
Nice. And, what are you doing with your time? I imagine you're assisting Robin with some of her work.
I'm also a penguin ranger now. I actually run the cameras through the breeding season myself. Now I've done it for 7 years or something. So this month I'm still reviewing the photos and videos that I've taken last breeding season. I haven't got through them all yet. And I'm being paid for that now. I did it voluntarily for a few years. It's quite nice to have a job.
Yeah.
That'll take me another month or so. So life's got fairly quiet at home without the kids. It's really nice when they do get home. Obviously, but time goes by. It's really nice having Kristen and Wanaka potentially hop in, even if it's only a couple of days. So the last few years, Robert's actually more and more happy to just be there. He comes out about twice a year still. Whereas I really need to get out for a bit of a break. So I'm probably coming out twice as often. I like to check out a couple of the kids and, you know, just spend some time, come out here and just be more appreciative of when I get of what I have and be more appreciative of what I have when I get home.
Yes, yeah.
Otherwise, sitting there just bored and potentially, you know, time goes on too long and I just lose the appreciation of it. It doesn't take me long. Mm-hmm. I just want to be happy to be there. It doesn't take me much out here to do that.
Nice. Cool. Yeah, so at the moment you're not at home. You're in Wanaka, but you're heading home tomorrow.
Yes, I should be home by tomorrow. I walked out last week and I'm here at Kristen's house at the moment.
Nice. Cool. And, yeah, before we wrap things up, is there anything you want to say that I haven't asked you about?
No, I don't think so. We've done pretty well.
No. Okay.
Oh, except maybe, sorry, I did say that Kristen's book enough, didn't I? Yeah, that's fine. That will do anything.
Okay, good. Cool. You said his book is coming out in April, right?
Yes, middle of April.
Yeah.
And he's taking pre-orders already on his website, which is Wild Kiwi Adventurer.
Wild Kiwi Adventurer.
He's got a YouTube channel. There's also Instagram and Facebook. But you'll probably find him somehow on those.
Yes, yeah. I have seen those. Now, so my final question for you to end on is if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
Don't overpopulate the planet. I feel very strongly about there being room on this planet for species other than humans.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.